Good afternoon. If I could call the meeting to order. A motion, you should have the agenda in front of you. At this time, I think we'll just kind of skip around the room and do introductions. John, maybe starting with you.
John Sachs, Hauk, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Sandy Rummel, Met Council representing Sioux Hague.
Charlie Zelli from the Department of Transportation.
Will Seifert, EQB.
Dave Fredrickson, Department of Agriculture.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Eric Tomlinson, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Tom Landwehr, DNR Commissioner.
Kristen Idy Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Michelle Beeman, Pollution Control Agency.
Brian Napstad, Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Excellent. I'd like to go then to our proposed.
Mr. Chairman, we had a.
Matt Mossman, Commissioner of Administration.
That's right. Our policy is if you're here before it's over, you're on time. So not a problem.
And I'm early then.
Also, we do have Katie Clark Sieben, who is at home. Welcome, Commissioner Sieben.
Thank you.
As many of you know, Katie is going to be giving birth to a set of twins, and I understand you are on permanent bed rest right now. Is that right?
I am at the moment,
yes. That's great. I've been looking for that all my life, and so enjoy it.
Hey, when you give twins, we're all going to be there.
When pigs fly, as they say. And I see Senator Marty is here. Welcome, John. Good to see you again. Let's us go then to the adoption of the agenda. You should have it in front of you, and I would take a motion to approve the agenda.
Move approval.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. I failed to get a approval of the minutes for the August meeting. If you look in your packet, you will find two sets of minutes, one for Wednesday, August 20th, which took place at the Duluth City Council Chamber. You'll remember that Mayor Ness came in very quietly to meet with us and speak to us, and he stepped on the power cord and completely wiped out audio and visual. So he thought it was a pretty good way to make his entrance, but we appreciated him taking the time to be there. Then also the second set of minutes would be for September 17th here at in this facility. So they're pretty straightforward, just the facts. So unless you would like me to read them in their entirety, which is not a pretty sight, a motion to approve would be in order.
So moved.
There is a motion.
Second.
There is a second. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. I'll move then to the Executive Director's report. We have a fairly substantive agenda with reports today, so we'll move quickly to Will and then get on with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be pretty quick because we have a lot to cover, but I just wanted to say we're pretty excited today because we have two of our signature interagency initiatives that have been underway for the year. That will be presented. One will receive the final report for the NGA Clean Energy Economy Profile, and the other being Climate Solutions and Economic Opportunities. You're going to receive a preliminary report today. So this is pretty exciting that we get the opportunity to hear both of these presentations. Both of these projects have involved a high level of interagency coordination over the past year, helping us better understand the broad economic benefits incurred by our clean energy policies and helping us better understand options for mitigating climate change and the potential for future growth in our economy. Thank you to the staff who have done the heavy lifting on this work and to the commissioners for your leadership on these projects. We're very excited that we've had the opportunity to work with outside consultants who bring expertise on analyzing these policies and assessing their impacts. Thank you, Tom, for joining us here today to present. We're just as excited that the participating agencies have made the investment of staff resources to participate in and support this effort. building the data inventory and institutional capacity to carry much of this work forward. I can't belabor this point enough, watching so many agencies come together and divert technical staff resources to this project. We hope we can build off of this and sustain this going forward. So thank you. Thank you for your support of this. I also want to quickly acknowledge Bill Grant and David Thornton for your hard work in helping to steer this project, and Anna Henderson for your hard work in managing the project. As a reminder, we initiate our stakeholder process for CZO tomorrow morning at the Science Museum. So if you can join us, please do so. And this will start a series of sector-specific meetings going forward. And so we'll continue to share the schedule with you all on that. And our next meeting is scheduled for December 17th. And we'll be presenting you all with interagency updates to the EQB Energy and Environment Report Card that was first published in 2012. So that's all.
Excellent. Let's roll then directly into the Minnesota Clean Energy Economy Profile, and welcome Bill Grant.
And that's Weston. Weston,
yeah. Welcome, Mr. Merrick. I love that name, Weston Merrick. I mean, it really has substance. I mean, it could be like Dave Frederickson. I mean, it's just like Weston Merrick.
I had a big role in actually picking it.
Yeah.
I
remember that day. Solid.
Well, you're going to get Bill Grant to start with.
Sorry about that.
Mr. Chairman. But I will be turning it over to Weston shortly. So we wanted to give you an overview of the project as Mr. Seufert indicated that we've just wrapped up, and really significant, I think, in that it was a very much a collaborative effort across agencies. It really was an opportunity to align our clean energy policies that we've been working on for a number of years with our economic development strategies, and hopefully this is not just the end of this project, but the beginning of a long-term relationship, not only between our two agencies, but also between the efforts around those two concepts. And I think we all feel that it was highly productive and successful, if only for the fact that we're now talking to each other on an almost daily basis. So that was not necessarily the case beforehand. So I'll jump right into this. This project, as you might recall, is part of a larger effort undertaken by the National Governors Association to assist what turned out to be four states, in addition to ourselves, states of Arizona, Mississippi, and Puerto Rico, were selected in a competitive solicitation to participate in this policy academy. And as you can see, it was led by our two agencies, but involved a number of people across state government and external stakeholders, and we'll be getting into that more in a minute. So the objectives really were to create a clean energy strategy for Minnesota that could do a number of things. First, to allow us to really compete in the global market for clean energy, which, as you probably know, has been growing tremendously over the last few years, now estimated at over $1 trillion worldwide. We want to make sure that Minnesota gets its piece of that action. We want to grow small businesses in Minnesota and create high-paying jobs. And one of the things you'll see in our findings is the quality of the jobs, not just the quantity of the jobs that are common in this industry. We want to reduce dependence on imported energy. As all of you know, Minnesota doesn't have its own indigenous sources of fossil fuels or nuclear resources. We import all of that to the tune of about $18 billion a year. That's money that could be circulating more in the state's economy if we were more reliant on in-state sources, which also just happen to be those sources that are the cleanest sources, the renewable sources, and energy efficiency. We want to mitigate price volatility, and that's another benefit of becoming more dependent on sources that don't rely on volatile fuel, volatilely priced fuel as its input. And we want to achieve environmental emissions goals. And as you know, that effort has only grown in importance over time and now includes the very urgent need to reduce global carbon emissions. So the components, the major components of this work were really threefold. First, we wanted to do a much better job than we have in engaging the industry that's already involved in clean energy work in Minnesota. And what we found, not surprisingly, but it had never really been quantified before, is that we do have a very significant sector of our economy that is engaged in clean energy development and production. And we want to be able to identify those segments and do a better job of predicting, for example, if we adopt a new policy in the clean energy space, what is the jobs impact going to be? Next, we wanted to establish a consistent set of metrics for how we measure the clean energy economy. What are the things that we're looking for across all of these various sectors? And it's a very diverse sector, as you'll hear in a minute, including the things you would expect: wind and solar, biomass, biofuels, increasingly smart grid technologies, and easily the largest of our sectors, the energy efficiency sector. And we wanted finally to be able to document growth in this sector and be able to do that on an ongoing basis. So rather than just taking a snapshot of the industry, we want to be able to put in place a methodology for understanding the clean energy sector going forward. There are a number of strategic development opportunities that we identified through this process, and you can see them here. And they're all important, and all of them are things that we've been working on in the past but need to do a better job of. I'll just pick out a couple. Removing industry barriers. A number of you are involved in Minnesota Business First Stop. Well, that's one place where we really work to try and reduce the transaction costs for businesses in dealing with state government, and that's especially important to the clean energy sector. We wanted to expand education and marketing for these programs, and we've looked at a number of policy suggestions that I think we'll be debating this year and in the coming years about how we do that and how we do a better job of making sure that consumers are aware of clean energy opportunities that they can take advantage of and help grow that sector as well. And another really important one is improving access to financing. I just spent a couple of days in New York talking with colleagues from around the world about financing strategies that they've developed to really target the clean energy sector. It's something that we need to take a closer look at here because we have a number of entrepreneurs in this sector who very often can't be successful because they lack access to low-cost capital. So those are just a few of the things. I'm going to turn it over to Weston at this point and then come back to you at the end.
Thank you very much, Bill. That was a wonderful introduction and great context for how this report, the Clean Energy Economy Profile, fits in the broader effort of the state to try and align clean energy strategies and economic development. My name is Weston Merrick, and I'm an analyst with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And what I think we have with this report, if I can advance the slides, is something that's pretty neat. And actually, not just my perspective, what people with a lot more experience and expertise in clean energy have told me is that this is one of the most comprehensive looks we've ever had at the size, scope, and composition of the clean energy economy in the state. And in my own research, I've run across only a handful of other states, and a small handful at that, that have this deep of a publicly available dive into the clean energy industry. I think that's pretty powerful, and I think that's also a testament to the state's dedication to clean energy and in forwarding the clean energy economy. So very large interagency process. We've spent about a year going through this report, compiling stakeholder thoughts, working with our consultant, but we can boil it down to just two main takeaways. The first is that because of advancing technologies, as well as very conducive policies in the state of Minnesota, we've had exceedingly rapid growth in the industry, both in terms of production and also in terms of employment. On the production side, we've seen triple-digit increases in biofuel capacity, wind and solar installations, and cumulative savings for energy efficiency. And when I say triple-digit, I mean at the bare minimum, each one of those different production metrics have at least doubled over the last 15 years. On the employment side, we've gone from around 8,500 clean energy employees in the year 2000 to more than 15,000 clean energy employees in the first quarter of 2014. That's a 78% growth during the period. By comparison, the state overall has seen employment growth of around 11%. So clean energy employment has grown 7 times faster than overall state employment. Bill did a great job talking about our opportunities in the market, as well as the growth that's happening in this market. And one of the things that's been interesting while on this process, I'm sure Commissioner Fredrickson and Executive Director Sufert have recognized that often when we talk about clean energy, we talk about growth, we talk about opportunity. What I think this report does a very good job with is actually pushing back and talking about the sizable contribution that the clean energy economy is already making on the state of Minnesota. In the year 2013, clean energy contributed $1 billion in wages to the state economy and also paid wages, average wages, to its employees of around $71,000 a year. By comparison, the state average annual wage was around $50,000 a year, so 40% higher wages paid to industry workers. On the production side, what we're able to do with clean energy is replace traditional fuel imports, as Bill talked about, those $18 billion in coal, petroleum, natural gas imports with local production and local wages. We've already seen this start to occur. From the year 2000, we had about 6% of our energy produced from renewable sources. And by last year, we had around 20% of our energy produced from renewable sources. And that's going forward to 25% and beyond in 2025, thanks to our renewable energy standard. Now, I want to take a step back and talk a little bit about our method. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because from what I've been told, us non-analyst types don't find methodology as exciting and enthralling as perhaps
oh,
I do.
Oh, that is not true.
I have a 40-page methodology to give you, actually, then. And that's readily available online. We get into very minute details of our method, so it's all out there, and I'll talk about the website and where that's available. That's your Friday night reading, I'm sure. So our method, we hired a consultant to help us through this process. They brought along with them a methodology. The consultant's name is Collaborative Economics. They brought with them a methodology they used most notably in a Pew Research study from 2009 that explored employment in clean energy across the U.S. They also used a similar method in California and Colorado when examining their clean energy industry. We also supplemented it a bit, so I'll talk about that as well. The methodology they used is to investigate the National Establishment Time Series Database, NETS for short. Essentially what this database is a census of every single company and establishment being just a single business location in the state of Minnesota and its employment and what they produced and their location over a 25-year period. We identified with our stakeholders, with the consultant, and with previous research, industry codes, or NAICS codes for those of you that are familiar, that are typically, that we typically find clean energy companies in. COECON, Collaborative Economics, then manually reviewed each one of those industry codes to try and find companies that have greater than 50% of their revenues from clean energy sources. In the case that they met that 50% threshold, we counted them entirely as clean energy. In the case they did not meet that 50% threshold, we did not count any of their employment. Now, we wanted to supplement this a bit because a lot of our largest employers do many other things, including clean energy. And clean energy is in no way the majority of their revenues. Perfect example of this is 3M. They do electronics, they do medical products, they do office products, they do post-it notes, and they do clean energy. They do smart grid, they do components for solar and wind installation, they do energy efficiency. But there's no way that 50% of 3M's revenues come from clean energy. In that case, they would not have been counted under the first prong of our methodology. Therefore, we issued some surveys to try and catch those companies. We found about 335 additional non-duplicitous companies that we didn't find in the manual review. Combined all of that employment together with wage data from Deeds Unemployment Insurance Wage Detail Database to get our results. The last part, the wage data methodology, is actually something that's unique for this report. To our knowledge, it's the first time that we've been able to verifiably link clean energy companies to their actual wages that they pay their employees. That's pretty cool, and we'll get into the results from that in just a second. So the report's broken into three primary sections: policies of production, employment and wages, and kind of the innovation, what's new piece. The first part is the policies and productions. What we found is that extraordinary technological progress and strong state policies like the Renewable Energy Standard and Solar Electric Rebate Program have aided to the tremendous growth in capacity and production in all clean energy sectors over the period. From 2000 to 2012, seen rapid growth in each of the above metrics that you can see. One of the things I always hate in PowerPoints is when you get tables. They're hard to read. They kind of defeat the purpose of something that's graphical. But I tried to plot this. It is utterly, utterly impossible to plot 10,000% growth in solar in any sort of meaningful way. We've seen remarkable, remarkable growth in each of those sectors, solar in particular. And yes, this is coming from a very low base, but over a 10-year or really 12-year period, that's tremendous growth. And if we looked at 2000 and 2014, it would be even more rapid. So impressive growth in each of those. But for those of you non-energy people in the room like myself, I have no idea, even working on this project for a year, what 1 trillion BTUs means or looks like. So we have some equivalencies. If we were to hypothetically take all our biofuel capacity over the last 10 years and use that to replace traditional fuels, we'd be able to power 1.7 million vehicles for 1 year. On the energy savings and renewable energy side, if you combine the savings from energy efficiency and what we produced in renewable energy, we've created enough power to power 1.4 million Minnesotan homes for 1 year. Moving on to the employment section. What we can see with this graph is incredibly rapid growth in clean energy employment and incredibly rapid growth in each of the sectors of clean energy. Energy efficiency is by far our largest sector. In that sector, we saw around 50% growth from 2000 to the first quarter of 2014. In bioenergy, solar, and smart grid, we had at least a doubling of the number of employees in each of those sectors. And in wind power, we saw a four-fold increase in employees over the 14-year period that we looked at. The other thing I really like about this graph is that you can see that we have increasing diversity of clean energy sectors. In the year 2000, energy efficiency had about three-fourths of employees in the overall clean energy industry. By 2014, that percent had gone down to two-thirds. So we're getting increasing diversity amongst our clean energy sectors, and that's a good thing for the state. That's going to help with price volatility, and it's also going to bring more Minnesotans high-paying jobs. Looking at our sectoral payroll, we had over $1 billion in wages in 2013. It's up from $600 million in 2000. All of these are adjusted for inflation and in 2013 dollars. Beyond the actual payroll, total payroll figures, we had really good wages in clean energy as well. So we kind of mentioned $71,000 average wages. Now, there were some wide variances between sectors of what they actually paid. Smart grid paid the most at around $80,000 a year annually, while wind paid the least at around $62,000 annually. I think those make sense to me given the distribution of employment. Smart grid, you tend to have a lot of four-year degrees at a minimum, advanced degrees, terminal degrees, PhDs in the field. Whereas wind, you have more individuals that have technical degrees that are doing installation, maintenance, manufacturing. Now, that $62,000 a year annual wage is still 20% above the state annual wage during the period of $50,000 a year. So what's really exciting is that we can help individuals that have high school degrees get into technical schools, develop the skills that they need to get good wages in the wind industry. And I think that's pretty exciting, and maybe not a finding we initially expected when we actually looked into this report. The last section I want to get into is kind of that innovation piece, the R&D, early stage investment. I use the word innovation with some hesitancy because I think it is certainly an overused word that we use a lot of time in economic development, but I have metrics to back it up, so I feel a little more comfortable actually using the word here. Minnesota went from the number 20 in registered clean energy patents in 2003 to number 8 in 2013, one of the top states in the nation for clean energy patenting. Moreover, we were number 3 in the Midwest, just barely behind Michigan and Illinois. So very, very high patenting rate going on in the state. Some of the top patenters, kind of what we'd expect, our Fortune 5s and our large corporations, our Honeywells, our 3Ms, our Emerson Process are doing a lot of patenting in this space. What's also kind of neat is if you look at the grayish-brownish color on the bottom, I know it's a little bit hard to see on the screen right there, that's our smart grid sector. Minnesota smart grid sector was number 6 in the number of registered clean energy patents. And this is a very, very rapidly expanding space, and this is a huge opportunity for us. This is not just because of our big companies that we have here, but part of the strength comes from a really, really robust smart grid research cluster or activity that's going on at the University of Minnesota. In fact, the individual who's often credited with coining the word smart grid, Dr. Amin, is a professor at the University of Minnesota. So this is something that we have a big opportunity to capture and to leverage going forward to create more jobs, create more wages in the state. The last data slide I want to get into is venture capital. Minnesota was number 2 in the Midwest for venture capital clean energy technology with over $422 million over the last 10 years. The report also goes into very good detail about not just venture, that earliest stage capital, but actually early stage capital where banks and corporations are beginning to jump in. I'm going to save that a little bit here for time space, but I encourage you to look at that because that's really when you start to get mature technologies existing, and we see banks and corporations feeling comfortable enough with the technology to jump in, and jump in often with much, much higher sums of money than venture capital firms. Nonetheless, venture capital here was robust in the state, $422 million. The one thing if I was looking at this graph, would think about, though, is what happened from 2011 to 2013. And that's one of the things we really talked to our consultant about and had them explore. And what they found is that this kind of was a something that happened across the U.S. And for those of you that are familiar with the venture capital space, there is something called the hype cycle, where we get some VC firms that have some great returns on clean energy technology or other technologies. Money starts to pile in from more VC firms, and then we get our first kind of big glitch that'll happen with any nascent technology, or maybe I should use a stronger word, bankruptcy, that'll occur in any young technology sector. 2011, if you recall, the The most notable bankruptcy in the space was Solyndra. So we start to see companies pull back a little bit, VC firms do a little more due diligence, but still lots of money invested in the space in 2013 at around $50 million. And also with this, you start to wonder, is this emerging technology as much anymore as is this early stage? Do we need more mature capital in this space? So I think that's what's going on with this graph. The last thing I want to point to before I pass the mic back to Bill is our website. All of this information is readily available online. The website's min.gov/deed/clean. There are flyers on the table over there that have that website. The report's out there, the executive summary, as well as our full appendix and methodology. Also up there, very, very neat. We had some very generous contributions that allowed us to make some very cool infographs. We have them for the state overall. We have them for each individual sector, as well as each individual region. And it gives you a quick glimpse in a very graphically appealing way of what's going on in the state of clean energy.
So thanks, Weston. And just to sum this up, I think what we're seeing is that energy from renewable sources is making up a growing percentage of our state's energy mix, and that's been clear for a while. It's particularly true in the electricity space as well as in the biofuel space. Clean energy is providing what I think we really learned here is that clean energy is providing the state with a growing number of jobs at high wages. I think we always suspected as much, but we've confirmed that now, and as Weston has indicated, created a methodology for tracking that growth going forward. And this really positions us, as I said before, to be a more active participant in what is an international growth in this sector and something that I think Minnesota enjoys a comparative advantage in a number of these sectors. And so that's a very exciting thing. As I said before, we spend a lot of money on imported fuels, and we have an opportunity to begin turning that ocean liner in a better direction, at least for our economy's sake. I think, as the point has been made, we have an opportunity here to diversify our energy mix and improve our economic security as we do so, while obtaining a number of the other benefits, most notably the environmental benefits associated with clean energy. So we think that this whole effort was a smashing success. Hope you think so, too. We'd be happy to take any questions or comments that you have about it.
Thank you, Weston, and thank you, Bill. Mike?
So I just want to take a few seconds here to thank you guys and applaud all the great work, Bill and Weston, not just yourselves, but the staffs from all of our state agencies that went into this effort, the work that was done with the National Governors Association, the Collaborative Economics Group that helped on the project, and then in all the stakeholders that helped feed in the data that was critical to pull all this together. So it's an amazing effort, and we're at a place now where we can now, we understand the metrics, we know the potential, and how important this sector is to Minnesota, and actually in the subsectors. So again, I just want to applaud you and thank you for your great work.
And the governor has always said you can't change what you don't measure, and so we have a baseline, we have a measurement to start with. And it was interesting how the National Governors Association dangled a $5,000 bill out in front of us, and we bit.
Easy. It didn't take much. No, that's right.
It didn't take much. It was something we probably would have done anyhow, but they provided the bait, and we took it, and we also then, through the help of foundations and obviously through state agencies, I think it'd be difficult to quantify on an hourly rate of what we spent on this, but again, I think the work was substantial, and we have something to be really proud of and thank both of you for your hard work. Other questions or comments?
Chairman, if I might, just on that point, we probably should also acknowledge the fact that we did have strong support from private foundations, particularly in supporting the collaborative economics work, and we also work closely with our former colleague, Ellen Anderson, on this from the beginning, and of course she's working in a different role now, but was a strong early supporter of this and part of the co-chair team that helped drive this forward.
Absolutely. Anna and her sidekick, Anna Sherman, of course, and now Deed has stolen her from me. Thank you very much.
Not giving her back.
Yeah, great. So, Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who to direct this question to, whether it's Bill or Weston. I suspect it's Weston. You seem to enjoy data, so I believe this is where it's going. As you looked at the data, as you presented the data, a lot of it was presented over a decade time frame, for example, the 10,000% increase in solar. Through your observation of the data, did you see anything that wasn't in the report just yet? For example, let's say that 10,000% increase just occurred. Let's say the majority of the increase happened over the last 1 year. In other words, the exponential hockey stick. Did you see anything in the data that you would report on anecdotally to say that this looks like an area that is really going to grow, or conversely, this is an area that appears to be tapering off?
Absolutely. You know, that's a wonderful question. There were a lot of interesting aspects that we didn't have the opportunity to ride on with this data set. The thing that actually struck me was how remarkably steady the growth was in pretty much all of the clean energy industries. Now, you get into something when you get into individual sectors, you can see a very tangible influence of one or two major employees coming in. Something like Smart Grid, where it's not overall that large, you can see firms entering and exiting. That's pretty interesting. The report wasn't scoped to try and make guesses of what's going to happen in the future. But if anecdotally, myself looking at the data and looking at the investment that's going, if we have a policy environment that's similar to now, and not just a state policy environment, but a federal policy environment that's favorable, my expectation is continual steady growth.
Thank you.
Michelle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sort of along that line, I was wondering, was there any particular policy that you started to identify as if this would just change, this could really take off in any one of those particular sectors, sort of the next steps of analyzing that for policy development?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. And, of course, what you're about to hear about next is the work we've been doing in the Climate Strategies Economic Opportunities work, which has identified a number of strategies that so far we have a pretty good sense for how much they cost and how much greenhouse gas emissions they would save. The next step being to forecast their impact on employment and job growth in the state. I think we'll have a much better sense after we see that data about which of these are the big winners and which the state should really be pushing hard on.
Absolutely. And if you don't mind, kind of in the past as well, and yeah, your question was more forward-looking, but in the past, we can look at what policies occurred in the state, and it's utterly impossible. These are complex industries, complex sectors, and firms are making decisions on very, very complex things. So we can't say causation around policies, and we don't try to. One of the things we try to do is in the report, you'll find in the first section, we do look at what time frame changes in capacity occurred versus about when did policies happen. And so that's an interesting way to look at it in a correlated fashion. We won't say causation, but that's one way we can look at it, and I recommend looking and exploring the report in the first chapter about that.
Commissioner Clark Sieben, I know that you were extremely instrumental in moving this along, and wondering if you might have a comment or two.
Sure. Well, Bill and Weston did a fantastic job presenting the information today. And one thing that I'm very excited about is this is the first ever Minnesota Clean Energy Economy Report. It's gotten a lot of attention. Will Seeger wrote an op-ed highlighting this report, and so it's exciting to see also how the public has responded to this information. So we think that there's a fantastic opportunity ahead with the information that's been uncovered through this report. Of course, DEED is working closely with Commerce and the Department of Ag and starting to think about next legislative session. So I would expect that some of our proposals for the governor to consider will be based on information that was uncovered through this report and the broad array of stakeholders that were engaged in the steering committee. We had everyone from the State Chamber of Commerce to small nonprofits engaged in that steering committee, and also held a Clean Energy Summit earlier this year where we had a large audience participating in this work. So I think this is only the beginning of the clean energy work, and excited to see what we might be able to accomplish in this next session.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? If not, Mr. Merrick, Mr. Grant,
thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. No action is required. Members, on that, we're going to move now into climate solutions and economic opportunities, and I would invite Tom Peterson and Dave Thornton, Assistant Commissioner from PCA, to come forward. They are sneaking up. Hello. Thank you.
I think it's going to take a moment to pull up the presentation. So, Will, do you have any more introductory comments you'd like to make?
Yes, Will does have some.
I didn't think of any, but thank you for the invitation to ramble about.
Well, we're ready to go now.
thank you for cutting me off, too.
I'd like to introduce Tom Peterson, who's president of the Center for Climate Strategies, a organization in Washington, D.C. that has been helping us do the analysis that he's about to present. This has been funded by a lot of nonprofit organizations that we're really grateful for. And as Will said earlier, quite a number of state agency employees who, in addition to their full plates of duties, have spent quite a bit of time helping us think through some of this. And we're pretty excited about these preliminary results. We have some work that is ongoing. In particular, none of the big picture macroeconomic analysis, trickle-down jobs and things like that has been done yet. That will be ongoing, and we hope to begin rolling out some of that information in December and January. Some of the policies, the analysis is still being finished, and so for a couple of them, you're not going to have any numbers presented today. And as Will mentioned, we have a stakeholder process that begins tomorrow where we're going to start getting more detailed input into this. And so with that, I will turn this over to Tom Peterson, and then I'm going to be back in a minute with a few things.
Thanks, David, and welcome, Mr. Peterson. Welcome to Minnesota, the home of all your cousins. So, I mean, Petersons don't live in Washington, D.C. They come from someplace, and no doubt from Minnesota.
Well, don't tell anybody, but there was a point at which my last name had an E rather than an O.
Oh, well, at least you moved in the right direction then.
I thought it might help just a little. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today, and also for the opportunity to be able to help the agencies work on this project, which obviously is core to our mission in helping find solutions to the issue of climate change, but not just to that issue, simultaneously to find economic and energy and resource and resilience and other goals that we can achieve at the same time. And I'd like to walk through then where we are in this process right now, which is about halfway, and a lot of additional work, as David indicated, is forthcoming, but I think this will set a pretty clear foundation for what we've achieved so far and a platform for what we will be developing going forward. Just a little bit about us. We're a nonprofit organization. We've done a lot of this work over the last decade. We are not an advocacy group, so we don't take positions on issues. We're not for or against any particular policy option that is proposed for design and analysis. We work with agencies and typically also with stakeholders to help them go through a process of making those decisions, and we provide technical and facilitative assistance for that. And we're working in other countries as well. And just one footnote here that may be of interest is often as we see headlines about national issues here in the United States that suggest we haven't done much about climate change and we're not going to, there's actually a very different read on that when you get outside the United States. My experience has been almost without exception, other countries are keenly aware of the progress that states have made on these issues, and they want to understand how to do that same kind of work. And this has blossomed into a full-grown worldwide movement, and it goes by different names: green growth, economic energy and environmental sustainability, low carbon development, low emissions development strategies, clean economic development, clean energy. Really, this is this whole world of multi-objective planning and analysis, figuring out how we create a better, safer world by getting energy, economy, and environment on the same page. Parenthetically, I teach courses in this area at Johns Hopkins University on economic, energy, and environmental security, and work quite a bit with our defense institutions and security and intelligence institutions and their students on connecting the dots between national security and sustainability. And they are substantial linkages there that are growing and becoming more broadly recognized here in the United States and worldwide. So while we have focused in this project strictly on issues pertinent to Minnesota, the truth is a lot of people are watching and learning and very interested in knowing the progress you are able to make here because it has much broader implications. As David indicated, this has been a collaborative exercise that has involved a number of different agencies of jurisdiction and a very significant number of staff people. I think it's ballpark 50 or so within the agencies. I'm not aware of any other state that has engaged this kind of broad-scale interagency process for the formulation of a multi-sector climate action plan. We have worked with many, many states that have had more limited staff participation and agency participation. But I think in this case, we really are sort of paving new roads here in terms of the degree of agency involvement in all of this. And just a personal thanks to Will, to Bill Grant, to David Thornton for the leadership that they have provided in setting that process in gear and managing it forward. We wanted to talk today just very quickly a little bit about the background of this process and how it's proceeded, and then David will share with us findings about business as usual emissions, the forecasted baselines that have been critical because they serve as a backbone then for the analysis of what we can do about it. And that'll be the final section in which we'll talk about the set of actions that have been identified in each of the sectors and each of the agencies as having significant potential for reaching these goals. In terms of our background, the work plan for the project is pretty straightforward. It was to establish updated baselines in all the sectors. David will do a walkthrough there. And then to identify and design new and enhanced policy options that are updates to 2008 planning that we had conducted. And I'll comment in a moment on how that was done. And then for a set of targeted actions then that emerge from that in each of the sectors which we've delineated here to evaluate potentially their direct and what we call indirect impacts. And we've provided technical assistance to that process, and there will be additional activities to follow where we will continue to provide technical assistance. It will be culminating in a final report that contains all of this information. we brought a team of people here. And just so you know, in terms of their background, the people who are leading the work in each of the sectors are specialists in those sectors and the issues that relate to them, policy design, policy implementation, policy analysis. These are also people who are well-versed in the instructional and facilitative environment. So they have worked naturally with the people in the agencies through processes of joint decision-making. As I mentioned, this has been about getting some important things on the same page. It's not easy, but it is certainly doable, and I think we'll see some evidence later in this presentation that this is a possibility, and more than a possibility, it's a probability, we think, here in Minnesota. At the end of the day, we define policy as what you do and how you do it. So this process has been about figuring out what you do in each of the economic sectors and how you do it, which instruments do you use, whether they're codes and standards, technical assistance, et cetera. And at the end of the day, this goes into a matrix that matches them together and says, okay, for this sector, the first one, ES, is energy supply or the power generation and heat production part of the economy, a series of actions will be identified and they'll be implemented through various tools. And so we match them together into this portfolio. And everything that you can imagine about portfolio development, analysis, and management really does apply to the policy development process. This has all been about portfolio development. This will transition as we move forward to an investment platform, a portfolio that can be understood as linking policy and investment. And that is of some significance because the implications of these actions will have significant funding requirements associated with them. Lots of detail here. The big picture is step one, to get organized. Step two, to hammer down baselines. Step three, to understand potentially what our response options are to shift those baselines in the right direction. The next step is to evaluate them in some numerical way, and to do that in a way that pins down at a really specific level what those choices involve. To understand also how these actions will be implemented, to document that carefully, and then to move forward with actual implementation. This has been the methodology, if you will, for this process. Again, it has involved identifying potential actions. We'll look at how that was done momentarily, prioritizing them into the ones that look like they are the best fit for meeting the goals of the process, going into specific design for each and every one, the timing, the level of effort, coverage of parties, et cetera. Understanding then how to evaluate these in terms of choices of analysis, data sources, methods, key assumptions, and then how to implement. So what's behind the treetops of the numbers that we give you today is in actuality quite a bit of detail, and it's extremely explicit, and there are background documents that will walk through chapter and verse that you can refer to. Today we'll just be looking at summary versions of things, but recognize that the details underneath them are both significant and they are explicit. We started the process with some basic rules of the road, some guidance documents, the first being some rules around analysis. And these are standard principles and guidelines that have been specifically adapted to issues of concern here in Minnesota. For instance, how do we handle in-state versus out-of-state impacts, things like that. So the rules of the road are spelled out. That document is online and available for review. We will be running numbers on jobs and other macroeconomic impacts. That also has a guidance associated with how it's done and why it's done. And we will see in a minute some screening and design strategies we used for picking and choosing and designing these strategies that will link to the previous presentation on clean energy and clean economic development, and we'll point out how those two have intersected. And then some other specific tools and templates that have been used to go through this process. It takes a lot of tools to go through this. They have to be brought together in a coordinated fashion. Economic development strategies.
So we have looked at the results of many state climate action plans and the specific actions proposed in each sector and what impact they had on jobs, income, economic growth, prices, productivity, a series of macroeconomic variables. And then we took a look at the whole batch and teased out of that, through regression analysis, six strategies that were designed to win. These are things that can help us identify which actions you take will be most likely to work well economically and how you design them to do that so that when you do run the numbers, they're likely to show the best result. For instance, lower cost approaches, things that are more cost effective, save money that can be freed up for reinvestment, has an expansionary effect, et cetera. You'll notice one of the things up here is moving supply chains and moving resource acquisition and technology acquisition in state instead of out of state so that you're keeping dollar bills at home instead of sending them away, or in the case of investment, bringing investment in rather than simply making transfers within the state. So these are empirically derived, they're tested, they're proven. The question is how well can we fit them to what we're trying to accomplish here. And it's part of a transition process that we see worldwide, which is the transition from getting started in any one of these areas and then gravitating it forward so that it demonstrates, it scales, it goes domestic, and ultimately you can become an exporter of any particular technology or service. The clean energy area, again, that was referenced in the previous presentation, is very much on this road. And the policy development and barrier removal process you are going through this climate strategies and economic opportunities process is really designed at the front stage here through policy framework barrier removal to get this ball rolling and then to set the stage for implementation actions that will follow that will enable the state to expand its economic presence in this area in a highly effective manner. Parenthetically, we work in China on low carbon development. There is a very strong parallel interest there. And if I'm not mistaken, your number two trade partner after Canada is China. And so there is a really significant interplay here between the policy actions that you take here in this clean energy area, your ability to play in world markets. That has certainly been incorporated into the considerations that we have brought to identifying and designing policies. Lots of details on how baselines were developed. David is going to explain all of that to you here in just a minute. But it's basically figuring out which direction each of our sectors are headed, business as usual, what those scenarios look like, and then what happens when we start to shift them. The screening process, this is the business of how we came up with the 30 policy options that are the basis for this portfolio. And the tool that was used is something known as multi-criteria analysis. It's basically saying, what are the performance metrics you're looking for? How do your potential options screen out, and benchmark out, and rank out on those? And then when you sift through them and you rank them out and literally ballot them with the help of the agencies who are reviewing them, what rises to the top? And so this is a systematic, information-based, expert judgment-based process that resulted in the selection of 30 specific options for analysis. They were not picked out of the blue, and they weren't the subject of arbitrary decisions and determinations. These were the result of shared, informed, systematic decision-making by the agencies with our assistance. This is literally the table that was used with the performance metrics at the top, and you can see a listing of the sectors going down in terms of rows, and there was a ranking scheme that was numerical that was associated with it. So I want to underscore the fact that the list of options, while they're not guaranteed to be the best, were the product of very significant early evaluation and consideration. And the 30 policies that resulted from that process fit in each of the economic sectors. Each of these is different.
Some of these are great big fat things, and some of them are little bitty skitty things, and some of them are things that have three or four things under the hood, and some of them stand all by themselves. And there's been this whole business of lumping and splitting, but these are the actions, the what you do in each of the sectors that rose to the top. And we'll look at these in a little bit more detail later, but it covers power generation, the predominant option there being the renewable portfolio standard, a series of things on demand side management, energy efficiency, process improvements for buildings, facilities, manufacturing, transportation and land use, a combination of things that help us reduce demand for travel and other forms of transportation and make it cleaner, things in agriculture that help us to install and expand conservation practices and the protection of land, the same for forestry, and then for waste management, things that reduce the production of waste and allow us to recycle it or recover waste from it so that we're becoming more efficient in resource use. For each and every one of those options, these agency representatives and the assistants from my organization went through the process of determining, as a starting point, how should these be designed? This is very important because these are very specific options with specific design parameters that become the basis for analysis. The timing, when do they start and stop, and do they change and ramp up along the way? How aggressive are they? What level of market penetration, et cetera, are we targeting? Who has to do this? Who are the affected and implemented parties? At the end of the day, who has to physically implement these? And what tools are going to be used? Are these regulatory? Are these financial, et cetera? And what level of government? Is this going to be done all by the state? Or will it also be done to some greater or lesser degree by local government, by the national government, or by a multi-state regional mechanism? So this has pinned down these basic design parameters for each and every one of these options. And along with that, the best way to go about evaluating their performance against the basic indicators that were used to screen and select these options in the first place. Best available data sources, methods, key assumptions, and how do we handle uncertainty, which is typically being done through sensitivity analysis. This is part of having a detailed open book process in terms of how things are actually being selected, designed, and analyzed so that others can take a look at this and understand. The information I just covered with you is covered in significant detail in background documents that are available now publicly posted. These are called policy option documents. We abbreviate that by calling them PODs. But it's a little report that breaks down into a dozen different pieces on each and every one of these that will end up being in an appendix to the final report. But these are living drafts that are documenting this series of decisions, again, so that you understand the level of detail that has gone into what you will see before you today and the documentation associated with it. And now it's David's turn.
Any questions for Mr. Peterson at this point?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, board members. I think first, a brief pause and just a little reminder of what the goals of this process were. It was not to identify a comprehensive set of policies that would collectively achieve a certain goal. It was specifically to look at a discrete set of policies, examine their costs and benefits, and maybe through this process identify the next best step or two or three that the state might want to pursue in order to continue reducing greenhouse gas goals. So this is different than what we did back in 2007, and I think it's worth just remembering that. So for being able to analyze the benefits from an emission standpoint of a particular policy option, you have to know where you're headed without it. And so we undertook an effort at the PCA and with the help of many people at a bunch of other agencies to look at business as usual forecasts traditionally, we had taken our forecast out to about 2025, and through this process, we extended that out to 2030. We tried to be as internally consistent as we could between various different methodologies and such. We developed the forecast on a sector-by-sector basis. In fact, we developed all but two of the forecasts, and the Center for Climate Strategies did the crop forecast and the forestry forecast. We tailored the forecast to the particular conditions within each sector, and we had to take into account everything that we knew that was already on the books that was going to be happening within a particular sector. So, for example, I'll pick on the electric industry. We took into account all of the information that was available in each one of our utilities' integrated resource plans, which plans their activities out 15 years into the future. So to the extent that they were planning additional wind farms, that goes into the forecast. To the extent that they are planning additional hydropower from Manitoba, that goes into the forecast. To the extent that they're planning to close a coal plant, that goes into the forecast. And we also looked at both local and national sources of information regarding population expansion and such to begin trying to understand how some of these sectors might grow over the future. So to boil this down, this is a look at all of the different sectors. There are several things that we can learn from this slide. First of all, that our emissions, the total emissions are represented by the top of this graph. Our emissions began to turn a little bit at around 2005 and have gone down. You can see the effects of the economic downturn of 2008 fairly dramatically there. And then there looks like they're going to kind of flatten out as we look out into the future. The other thing that you should take from this is that looking up from the bottom, the largest sectors of this graph, which represents our greenhouse gas emissions in the state, at the bottom, the sector that contributes the most is the electric power sector. Above that, in yellow, is the transportation sector, and that includes planes, trains, and automobiles, as well as trucks and off-road equipment. In white, we have industry minus purchased electricity from the utility sector. In black above that, we have residential, and that would be essentially natural gas used for space heating. The electricity that you use in your residences is accounted for in the blue sector at the bottom, the electrical sector. Above that is commercial and green. Same conditions there, that's mostly space heating. In gray, feedlots and livestock. The little orange slice there is waste management. And on blue and top is crop production. So some sectors contribute a lot, some sectors not so much. And then for reference, in case you're interested, the Next Generation Energy Act goals, I don't have on this slide, and we'll have to change that because I think it would be easier to visually see them. But the 2015 goal would appear about two-thirds of the way down the light blue section at the top. The 2025 goal would appear at about the interface between the green slice and the gray slice. And the 2050 goal would be down into the blue at the very bottom. So not only are we currently forecasting that we won't meet the 2015 goal, we are also forecasting that we're going to miss the 2025 goal by quite a bit and aren't even coming close to the 2050 goal. This table just summarizes the changes that are expected by that forecast that I just showed you in the graph for the different sectors. For residential, we're looking at about a 13% decrease in emissions by 2030. In commercial, an increase of 18%, and I'll explain that in a minute. In industrial, an increase of 4%. Electric power, a decrease of 6%. In transportation, a decrease of 9%. In waste management, which was that little thin orange slice, a decrease of 18%. Feedlots, livestock, increase of 13%. And in crop production, it looks like a decrease of 8%, which is a total decrease of 3% of our emissions between now or 2011 and 2030. So looking at the electrical sector specifically, a big turnaround around 2005. Coal at the bottom is responsible for most of the emissions. Natural gas in yellow is growing a little bit. The municipal solid waste combustion and the transmission system is those little lines in the middle, and gray at the top is imported power. A feature of our Next Generation Energy Act is that we have to account for the emissions that are that come along with the power that we import, primarily from North Dakota, but from other states. So as you can see, this is kind of flattening out. Because this is our biggest contributor, I'm breaking this down a little bit to give you an idea of where things are really kind of changing here. Coal, again, is in blue, and it looks like it's staying fairly flat. Nuclear is yellow on this graph, and it's staying fairly flat. In this graph, natural gas is white. The difference between this graph and the other one is that wind and nuclear and zero emission sources of power weren't depicted in the previous graph. But in this graph, I'm showing them because this shows you that we are actually forecasting an increase in demand in our state between now and 2030, which reflects the population growth and everything else. But so even with this fairly significant increase in demand, at this point, without additional policies, it looks like the emissions from the electricity sector will be fairly flat. Natural gas is growing. Wind in orange is growing fairly substantially. And there's about a decrease of 27% of our total generation that's being imported down to 16% in 2030. So we're going to be relying less on imports by 2030 than we currently do. And I also want to point out that while the import sector, the gray part at the top of the graph, is mostly coal, a good quarter to a third of it is zero emission power that we get from North Dakota, for example, in wind, and hydropower from Manitoba. So I think that's worth noting.
Mr. Thornton?
Yes.
Sorry, can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Just to clarify, because it's difficult to see from here, the vertical line, is our 2014? Is that where we are? It's
vertical line
to
is,
see the x-axis.
Yeah,
so.
The vertical line is 2011.
2011.
And that was the baseline for this inventory forecast.
And we're looking
at... We have solid data for 2011. Everything to the right of that is forecasted.
Out to 2030? Is that
out
right?
To 2030.
Okay.
Yeah.
Difficult to see that.
And all of these graphs are going to be posted for people to look at, and all the information that went into this forecast work is going to be posted. Some of the latter part of that is not quite ready yet, but it will be in a few days. The transportation sector is one example of where we're continuing to make improvements. You can see that the curve was bent in around 2002, 2003, and it continues to go down. Part of that is related to a change in VMT growth in Minnesota, as well as around the country. But a lot of this is the result of federal action on CAFE standards for on- and off-road vehicles. And we're going to continue to see the benefits of CAFE standards as the fleets turn over and the standards get tighter out into the future. I should say that this graph does represent about a 10% decrease in emissions from the transportation sector out from now to 2030. But it does factor into it a continued growth in VMT of about 0.8%, which is the best number that our experts at the Department of Transportation and Met Council were able to give us. So VMT will continue to increase, but even in spite of that, we're going to get some reductions in emissions because of the CAFE standards. This is our industrial forecast. The different colors are essentially the sources: natural gas at the bottom, coal and coke in the yellow, refinery gas in white, and refined petroleum products in black. So those two lines are essentially emissions from our refineries. And the light blue at the top is process emissions. So if you're using degreasers that evaporate and contribute to greenhouse gas emissions, that would be in the light blue at the top. We're also forecasting that this is slightly increasing over this period of time. And that's good because there's a energy efficiency that's built into this forecast. So it does show that there is going to be some growth in industrial activity in the state. And that's a good thing. And with the energy efficiency work that's underway right now, it'll keep these emissions not quite flat, but nearly flat. For commercial, we're projecting an increase in emissions from the commercial sector. The scale on this one's a little different, but the line, again, is 2011 out to 2030. Natural gas is the major portion of this, but the growing part that happens out into the future is the release of HFCs that are used in refrigeration. The concern that equipment is going to continue to get old and leak and be replaced, and that those HFCs, which have a much higher lifetime in the atmosphere, will contribute more and more to greenhouse gas emission increases. And the total increase forecast for this sector is 18%, but there is a possible highlight here. The Obama administration recently published draft rules that would make illegal the use of HFCs in commercial refrigeration after 2016. If this becomes final, we think that will dramatically affect that dark green, aqua, whatever the color is, portion at the top, and could serve to flatten these emissions out quite a bit. So that's something to keep in mind. This is residential emissions. It's CO2 at the bottom in blue from natural gas, and there is also a refrigerant slice at the very top, and you can see that it's increasing, but it's not as bad with commercial. We're projecting a decrease in residential emissions, largely because of energy efficiency activities and the fact that our housing units that are being built are much more efficient than the older. Again, built into this is a population increase, so that's a part of the assumptions. This is waste management. If you remember on that original graph, it was the very small orange slice. So it's not really big potatoes, but there's still some opportunity here. The biggest change that's happened since around 1990, where this peaks, is landfill gas collection systems that have been installed in landfills, which are capturing methane and, for the most part, burning it and emitting CO2, but it's much better to emit CO2 than it is to emit methane. We've tried to turn that methane into energy, and for the most part, it's really hard to do in a way that's economically feasible. But without additional changes, waste management, again, assuming that we will continue to throw away more things, is expected to stay fairly stable. Livestock going up, mostly because of pigs. I'll just leave it at that.
Anything else to say?
There's different changes going on within the livestock sector, but the biggest source of the increase here is pig production.
Wild boars, I suspect.
And crop production is expected to be relatively flat over this period of time in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And then I think Tom's going to take over here and talk a little bit about the forestry.
Questions for Dave? Not Tom?
Forestry is a little bit different in that it includes both pluses and minuses. Because of photosynthesis, vegetation has the ability to pull carbon dioxide out of the air and convert it to fiber and sugar and to store it in that fiber above and below ground, in some cases for very long periods of time. And so we are showing a bar graph here that shows pluses and minuses. Everything, there's a zero line that things hover around. Everything above that shows a net emission, a net release of either carbon dioxide or methane or nitrous oxide. And beneath that, where you see, for instance, the purple bars on a net, it means carbon's actually being stored. And let me just read the categories for you on the right so you can understand the light shaded blue, or excuse me, the dark blue. It's a hard line to see. It's the lines that go below zero. And if you look at 2015 or so, you'll see two of them. That's forest carbon sequestration. That's the combination of the storage that results from this process I just described versus emissions that are caused by trees dying and being either combusted or chewed up by bugs or some other process. So it's a combination of pluses and minuses there. In red, we see woody wetland methane emissions, and the light green urban forest carbon sequestration. The purple is herbaceous wetland carbon sequestration. The light blue, which is above, will be urban wetlands methane emissions. The orange is grassland carbon sequestration. Dark something, blue, black, whatever, wildfire and prescribed burns, and then a burgundy somewhere, which is wildfire and prescribed burn and nitrous oxide. So two wildfire ones that have methane and nitrous oxide. We'll have a replacement slide that will put all of these together to show you the net line. But again, you can see this is a combination of pluses and minuses here, and it reflects dynamics that are occurring in all of these areas. Let me just shine a light on one significant dynamic that shows up here for the dark blue lines that go below zero during that 2015-year period for carbon sequestration. The two driving forces are the combination, on the one hand, of the loss of forest cover, the conversion of forest cover to some other cover through some, typically some change in land use practice, but it could also be because of changes in forest health. But we're losing forest cover from the land on the one hand. On the other hand, for remaining acres that do have forest cover, they are becoming stocked with more carbon. And so these two things are balancing against each other. Over time, what we also see going forward, and this is really, as I understand it, what starts to shift the curve a bit from 2020 or so going forward, is the effect of some forest health issues, particularly on ash, which is a significant component of the forest here. So forest health becomes a part of this equation also. Let me just note that this is a sector that is sensitive to the effects of climate change itself. This period of time was too brief for us to include climate change signals into these effects, but in the longer term, that is something that certainly does affect where this all goes in the future. The ability of this land to stay productive for forest, for grasslands, for crops, et cetera, will be significantly affected by changes in the climate.
So you probably have already reached these conclusions yourself. Our greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota peaked around mid-2000s. They're moving in the right direction, but they're not moving very fast. We are forecasting total emissions in 2030 to be about 7% below the 2005 levels, which is the baseline set for the next generation Energy Act greenhouse gas reduction goals. And I think it should be relatively obvious that if we're going to continue to make further progress on reducing emissions, we're going to need to identify some new policies.
Questions? Comments? Michelle?
David, I just was, because we don't have the slides in front of us, it's hard to, if you could go back to the slide that was the composite with all of the reduction, percentage reductions of the different sectors. And I just want to, If I'm reading that right, just if all the work done in residential, I mean, all the energy efficiency and all the work we do to try to, you know, make residential emissions go down, is looks to be completely wiped out by the increase, let's say, out of the agriculture sector. Is that a fair read of that?
Yes.
And is there, is there any predictions on how to change? That seemed to be the curve that was going in the absolute wrong way from a composite point of view.
There is a policy option or two that look at agriculture.
Okay.
And you'll hear more about that.
Okay. Since we mentioned policy, Senator Marty, any comments, or you're just here to learn today, right? Sure. Policy options. Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think it's more of a comment than a question. An observation of your last slide regarding forestry. I happen to come from a county where we have a forestry management plan, and we've been executing, you know, under the certifications for a long time. And it's interesting that you pointed out that your slide was preliminary because it takes a long time to measure some of these things. And we're finding the same problem. It takes us a long time to change over a forest. We actually have discussed plans to convert our forests from the present condition to a different condition, anticipating, for example, the emerald ash borer. And yet state policies prevent us from doing that. So it's kind of a catch-22. It's the process that takes the longest to change, and yet it's going to take us the longest to reflect on those state policies and change them. It's just an interesting observation that an area where we need immediate resolution in order to affect change in 30 years may take 10 years just to affect change.
Can you actually go back to the same slide that Michelle had us on for a minute? In transportation, the 9%, can you say more about is it mostly fuel efficiency standards? What are the single biggest things driving?
Fuel efficiency standards.
And what comes after that?
Fuel efficiency standards.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's the driver down. It's pushed against an increase in VMT that's occurring over that period of time. So if our VMT were flat, obviously the fuel efficiency standards would be resulting in more of a decrease.
And any impacts in terms of people moving out of rural areas into more urbanized areas, or the greater their ability to work from home kind of thing? Those are insignificant, I assume, relative to fuel efficiency standards.
I would say they're small.
Yeah.
We do have a couple of policy options that look at increasing transit opportunities and transit-related development, densification, that sort of thing, and to see how that could play into this, as well as there's some biofuels electric vehicles are several of the transportation-related policy options that we've looked at.
I think it also is wise to remember Professor Ball from Wisconsin and his famous quote, "All models are wrong, however, some are useful."
This one's useful. It's
my
wrong.
My point.
I'm sure it's wrong, but it's
I'm sure it is.
It'll be useful.
Other question, Eric?
As you guys were identifying metrics, I understand you're doing that based on available data sets. Is that a correct assumption? I'm curious if there was anything that you wish you had. If this data had been available, we might be able to X. And I'm just curious if you had run across anything like that, that if the state or isn't currently being collected, if there are any recommendations to begin data collection.
For the baseline work?
Yes.
I'm going to say that that's a great question, and I'll have to ask experts. I'm sure that there are multiple answers to that. We have, for example, relatively robust information in the electricity sector. They actually forecast their needs and the use of their resources out 15 years into the future. And for most other sectors, we don't have the same kind of information that's available. As just a quick initial answer to your question. The other thing, and I'll focus on the electricity sector again, it's very hard to track electrons. So it's hard to know exactly where our imported power is coming from. And it would be nice to be able to have better information on which plants are serving our load in Minnesota to be able to better reflect what that part of that slice of the graph might be.
Commissioner Roth.
Just to follow up on that and then my question. You know, part of that is determined by power purchase agreements and contractual relations. So that's a very key component of being able to determine or answer your question. So my question is whether or not, or maybe you can clarify, whether or not the forecasting includes in the baseline EPA's 111D modeling, and you know, anything you can shed on, or are you modeling that out as a potential option, and how you factor that in?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Rothman, it does not include EPA's 111D because that is not an on the books policy at this point in time. We are looking at 111D relative to a combination of a number of the utility sector policy options that Tom is going to talk about in just a few minutes. So we have it on our radar screen. We are going to be looking at it, but it's not reflected in that. And that what's reflected are the things that we know for sure that are going to happen, like things that have been committed to in integrated resource plans, power purchase agreements, and that sort of thing.
Further questions? Not. Mr. Peterson, you're on again.
Thank you.
Compliments on your handoff ability, the two of you. It's very well done.
We rehearsed all morning.
some background of what I'm going to show you, which is going to be on my many apologies, too many numbers, right? And so we run the risk of too much information, and I'll do my best to sort of share the detailed versions that you can then follow up on and look more closely at, but then give you the high points along the way. But just so you understand what we're looking at, again, the policy options in each of these sectors, as we mentioned before, were the result of this screening process. And these are typically expansions or enhancements of existing activities. So these are overwhelmingly based on proven approaches that are being expanded, as opposed to things that are unproven, brand new, absolutely innovative. The idea typically in these planning processes is to incorporate innovation along the way, but it's also been the case that these portfolios typically lean predominantly on the expansion of existing actions. So you'll see things that are expansions and enhancements. The second, as I indicated, these were derived directly from this whole process that the agencies went through in terms of reviewing past, present, and potential future options. And there were a series of performance metrics, but I would sum them by saying it was a combination of goal seeking and then feasibility, really asking hard questions around various kinds of feasibility considerations, whether they're economic or institutional or technical. Right now, all we're going to look at is the first half of the equation, which is what we call the direct or micro effects of these options, what happens in a very direct sense when you implement these. The macroeconomics will come back later. That'll be looking at the secondary effects. What happens when the dollars get spent the second and third time? This is just about what happens when the dollars get spent the first time. We'll come back with that. As you look at the numbers, you'll see some that look like they're high in terms of cost. Be careful not to interpret them as being negative because they're more costly. When we come back with you, we're going to show you in all likelihood options that cost more, but options that also have significantly higher than average rates of return for job creation. And so these can be viewed as investments, and we actually will bring back return on investment calculations. So again, at this stage, we're just looking at how much things cost and how much they save in a direct sense, but these will be illuminated quite a bit further as we get to the next stage. So we did not at this stage hang a price tag on other values here, particularly what we call the social cost of carbon. So the numbers you see today don't assume any benefit whatsoever for reducing the underlying risk of climate change. We'll provide those at a later point. That work is underway now, and it's going to be applying a federal methodology designed by the Environmental Protection Agency to put a price tag on the negative impacts of climate change avoided with inaction. Those numbers are significant, and they will help put in context that the numbers you see today actually are achieving some risk reduction that now is at a stage where it can be monetized, at least to a significant extent. So we'll be bringing that back. We're showing you numbers that are net. When you see a number that is net savings, and that'll be a negative number, it means not that this option is free, not that everything that happens is going to save money. It's looking at the combination of spending and savings combined and a net shift between the two. So every single one of these involves this net effect and realistically a set of winners and losers. And we can map that out more clearly in the next rendition. When we've calculated costs here, ideally what we would like to do is focus on what we call incremental cost, that a new policy option is going in place and it could be an enhancement to something that's already in place. And the idea is we want to quantify the cost and the value of that enhancement. Sometimes that's difficult to do right off the bat, and in those cases, we provided to you today something called total cost or total program cost, which means we haven't sorted out that incremental thing yet. And we'll see some options where the numbers look large. One of the reasons is we're counting the cost of implementing an entire program that was not designed for climate change purposes. It's something that we're scoring climate change benefits from as a co-benefit, and we'll put that in context for you when we come back. We split out in-state versus out-of-state greenhouse gas effects, so you can see how much of the achievement here is happening literally on the ground out-of-state versus in-state. Turns out it's not a huge effect, but what happens is that in some cases, these are all actions that are designed to be taken within the borders of the state of Minnesota. Sometimes the activities you take inside the state actually result in emissions reductions outside the state. The classic case would be if you're importing electricity from fossil sources, if you increase an energy efficiency program in state, it actually reduces the amount of power production that takes place out of state. And so there's a geographic effect. We see that happening also for waste management options. You may increase the level of recycling you have here or the level of source reduction that may cut back production outside of the state. So we're going to show you where those things are mapped. We wanted to be sure we captured that. It's not a real big issue here, but we've mapped it out just so you can see. This analysis only runs through the year 2030. And so the numbers you see today are going to be the evaluation of how much it costs and what you get back during that period of time. It does not attempt to quantify what happens after 2030, even though in most cases these options continue to live and produce well past that period of time. And we've put a column together and a table to indicate whether that's a high or low or medium, just to give you some sense. But in most cases, the actions you take within this next 15-year period continue for a long time. We didn't quantify some of the options, either because the group felt that the state of readiness in terms of data availability wasn't there yet, at least during this period of time, or for other reasons. But there are a couple that are not fully quantified, but they are going to be included and characterized, and we'll show you those. And then some of these have multiple versions. We'll show you two different versions of the renewable portfolio standard. We'll show you a couple different versions of some other options. So we've done some early scenario analysis for different versions of these things, and it means obviously at some point were the option to go forward, a decision would need to be made about which scenarios. And as David indicated, some of these things are in progress. The numbers we're reporting to you today are pretty close to the finish line. They may get scrubbed up a bit. There are some others that weren't as close to the finish line where we've got a lot of people still pinning down the details for analysis, and we expect that'll be done relatively soon. And before I then start showing you numbers, any other big picture questions?
Numbers.
Okay, so just think of a state budget, right, you know, and the madness that goes into pulling together a lot of different line items that cut across a lot of different departments and everything that goes into that process. You don't have binoculars, and this isn't a reference sheet that you can look at, but we're into the land of, you know, tables here. So let me just tell you what's in this table, and then we'll show picture versions of this that hopefully will make this a little bit easier. So let's just work downward first. We see some shaded blocks. The first, the third, you know, shaded area down is a light blue thing, and that is the bottom line for the power generation sector. And that looks at the renewable portfolio standard and then the modeling of some revisions to the Sherco plant. We then, in orange, have residential, commercial, industrial. These are the energy efficiency and process efficiency options. Then in purple, we have transportation and land use. In brown, we have agriculture. In green, we have forestry. And in something that looks like a sort of a purplish blue there right towards the end is waste management. And then in the green in the very bottom, we've got summary numbers for the whole thing put together. So this so it combines all the sectors and all the actions. When you look at each of these blocks, it contains each line is a policy option. So this analysis does something called standalone or line item analysis. You can literally go into each and every one of these and say, okay, if this was to go forward and nothing else happened, this is the effect that it would have. Then you see what happens when you put them all together in that sector, because there's interaction between them. It gives you an integrated effect as well. Now, we're going to be coming back to you with a completely integrated effect, which is what happens when you put the entire plan together, and that's a theoretical scenario, as if everything implemented simultaneously. But we do that because we want to show standalone and integrated effects, because they're both important. When you work your way across this table, and the tables that repeat themselves for the sectors, you start out with a number on the very left. We had to give these guys a number so we could keep track of them, and then a name, which the attempt was to put it in something close to plain English, but we may need to make improvements there. And then the first set of numbers you see are the greenhouse gas impact numbers. We ran a set for 2020, and we ran a set for 2030. And we've split them out in terms of in-state and out-of-state effects. And then we show... And then we show the cumulative, what happens when you do that all the way up to 2030 combined, and again, in-state and out-of-state. We wanted to be sure we captured this in-state, out-of-state effect, and you'll see that second cumulative number is in-state plus out-of-state combined. Then we get to the right hand of this and the set of columns there that will show the total cost or savings, and we do that, we did net discounted cash flow analysis, net present values. So we'll show that effect, which is cumulative through 2030. Then that's converted into a cost effectiveness number, dollars per ton. Spend or save a total number of dollars, and you get a total number of tons of stuff out of the air. You know, what's the dollars per ton there? And so we have a cost effectiveness number. And then, as I mentioned, the far right column has an indicator around how significant the effects are after 2030. Does this train keep chugging down the tracks? Yes, no, how fast? And so that's the overall spreadsheet here. You take a step back, you'll see when you look at the numbers in the shaded areas, and you can look at, you know, any of the numbers for emissions or cost and savings, I think what jumps out pretty quickly is in terms of emissions reductions, just that variable. Again, we haven't gotten to economic impact, the macroeconomic impacts yet. The power generation sector is the biggest, followed by the demand side of things, residential, commercial, industrial. These are the two really big sectors that drive the amount of emissions savings going on here, followed by transportation. And agriculture, waste, and forestry are smaller. They may be quite significant for other reasons. We'll pick up some of those other effects as we go further into the analysis. So not all sectors are created equal. The big kids on the block here are the top three, the power generation, power savings, and transportation. Okay. We'll do portfolio analysis of this for jobs, et cetera, at the next stage, so you'll have that too. But right now, this is just direct impacts. And we put this into something, I call it a step curve. People call it a marginal cost curve. This is just taking everything you just saw, and I think this is for year 2030 emissions, and it's saying for any one of these that's got a label, like this big blue bar that's on the right, it's called ES1. Now, that's the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and it's the bigger version of the two. And the width of that bar, how long it is, tells you how much junk it's getting out of the air. In this case, a lot. In fact, this gets more junk out of the air than anything else on this list by a pretty long shot, and that's why it's a wide bar. And if you look at where that bar sits relative to the zero line, it tells you how much it cost, in this case, cost per ton. So here's one that I think the number is about $20 per ton, and I can't recall the number of tons it gets out of the air, but for $20 a ton, you get a pretty big slice of the emissions pie. And you can see others are in different places. Some of these are shorter, and some of them are below the line, which means they actually, on a net basis, save money. And it's typical to see orange lines below zero because energy efficiency programs typically save on a net basis. It's more typical to see what we call supply-side options, shifts in the way we produce and supply energy, being above zero. To put things in perspective, the RPS numbers here at $20 a ton, it's a pretty competitive rate when you compare it to analyses in other states. We see at the very far right a green line for actually some forestry options. These are high. And one of the reasons they're high is because they did this business of counting all the costs associated for a program that may not have been designed for carbon purposes at all. And we'll see, you know, why that is the case later on. And we've got transportation options hiding in here and more of them to come, but which is number one, which is all the way to the right. If you've got the tables in front of you, you can see it. That's a composite of three different options, and the composite is a net cost figure, but underneath the hood there's at least one significant cost savings number. But we've tried to put this up because this is kind of an all-in-one look at the combination of cost effectiveness and emissions reductions. It's not the only performance metric. We will be coming back with jobs, economic growth, et cetera, later on. But this just gives you the look in terms of those cost effectiveness and emissions reductions combinations. Okay. This is then just an isolation on how much junk they're getting out of the air. And to the left, you see the two renewable portfolio standard options. And these are the big kids on the block. A couple scenarios for the other power sector option. Then it's followed by three of the residential, commercial, industrial energy efficiency options. And they have little red bars at the bottom of them. That little red bar is how much of that action takes place outside the state. A little bit, but not much. The first purple one is transportation, and then we go on to forestry agriculture options and more transportation options. So again, you see the domination of the power sector, residential, commercial, industrial, transportation starts to show up, forestry starts to show up. And in terms of cost effectiveness, the cost effectiveness of these individual options, and this is actually missing, I believe, at least one forestry option on the very far right that has very high cost because it's a total program cost. But that aside, you see this right-hand side, which is power generation and transportation. But on the left-hand side, and they cost on a net basis, but then on the left side, you see some of these transportation options actually are net savers, along with some of the forestry options. And I think that's a duplicate. So for each of the sectors, we'll do a quick isolation, and then we'll open this up for Q&A. The energy supply, which means heat and power generation, includes two renewable portfolio standards and then three scenarios for repowering Sherco 1 and 2 to natural gas. And all the metrics we just talked about there. The total numbers that we put together for the time being to show you what you get out of this sector, just so you know, include the biggest renewable portfolio standard option and then the very first Sherco repowering option. So it's got an aggressive RPS plus the repowering. And the repowering doesn't get you as many tons out of the air, but it's not quite as expensive. But the RPS is more expensive, but you can just see the percentage reductions from baseline that that gets you, which would be, what do we have here, about 4 to 17, what is that, maybe a 13% drop. And this is a very, very big drop in emissions. The penetration of the renewable portfolio standard in terms of displaced carbon is high. This is a big one. And this is an isolation on the individual performance of each of these in terms of greenhouse gas savings and then the cost per ton. So the energy supply, the renewable portfolio standard option at a cost per ton level is not that high. $20 a ton is just not in the business, really not that high. But because there are so many tons coming out of this sector, the total number looks big. And you convert that to cost effectiveness. Again, we're knocking at the door at $20 a ton or so. But that was sort of what we expected, and I think what the agencies expected. We didn't know we were going to get that, but I think this is consistent. Residential, commercial, industrial. I will read this if I'm capable of it to help you here, but we get combined heat and power, building codes. We did not quantify high global warming gases. Then we have a 2.5% energy efficiency goal and thermal renewable efficiency. So five options, four of which are quantified, and all of these but one, on a net basis, actually save money. How does that happen? There are a lot of reasons, and we've got a background document that'll explain some of them, but there are various reasons why there are current barriers in place to net savings. You mentioned there are some policy barriers in place in forestry, and there are policy barriers in place in other sectors as well. Just to pick on another state, when we worked in Florida about the same period here, it was illegal for utilities to meet service demand through efficiency or to charge premium prices for renewable energy. There were other restrictions. In the state of Georgia, the building codes, the roofing standards for residences, in the words of the utility representatives that we worked with in a process, they said the only way to make those more energy intensive is to simply remove the roof from the house. So, you know, part of this process is identifying barriers, which may include current laws and may include current rules and policies that can be targeted for reform or removal. And that opens the door for financial benefits that otherwise couldn't exist. In the agriculture sector, one of the ones that we have seen in the past, I don't know how prevalent it is now, is the restrictions on net metering. So farmers couldn't take methane production on site, convert it to energy, convert it to electricity, and put it on the grid. And we're seeing across the country that shifting so they can actually capture an income opportunity at the farm level that didn't exist. We also see this issue where we get fixed versus variable pricing that affects how much incentive people have to save energy. And so there are a lot of things going on that address this, what is sometimes viewed as a counterintuitive notion that, goodness, you can save money, and, well, gee, why isn't that already happening? Again, all these are savers in terms of the emissions reductions, and some of them are occurring out of state for the reason I mentioned earlier. But it's not a big effect here. It's not like you've got a huge wash of stuff going on outside of Minnesota that is driving your benefits here. In terms of cost per ton, these are pretty competitive. Not unusual. I wouldn't say these are unusual, but this sector is the one where you see pretty competitive stuff. Transportation and land use, the first set of options that are under number one have to do with different types of pricing. These were, again, derived from agency proposals, something called pay-as-you-drive insurance, a carbon tax, and a fuel tax. And these have variable effects. The very first one is really getting at this fixed versus variable pricing issue on insurance and letting people opt into a system where they pay less if they drive less for insurance. This ends up being a net saving option. We move on to the second one, which is two versions of compact metro development. The first one actually capitalizes quite a bit on the effect of having denser and more proximate development that brings along reduced energy spending on site on the buildings, as well as the transportation and travel back and forth between these areas. The second one is more focused on the vehicle miles traveled effect. So one of them has to do with more so density and design, and the other more so with proximity issues. And then we see these combined as well. And then the third one is a mass transit, metro mass transit, and the fourth one is electric vehicles, which is still in progress and is a complex issue, so we're scrubbing that pretty hard, and we'll be coming back with that. And more of the performance here, positive cost here for the composite of the first one, but there's some positives and negatives depending on which you go. The pay-as-you-drive is a net saver, and then the others are actually net savers, but the pay-as-you-drive has a significant impact. More here in terms of savings, the greenhouse gas savings, you'll see again the first one, big impact, but not much impact out of state. And cost effectiveness numbers, which vary. Okay, agriculture, fertilizer reduction, cover crops, the increase in use of perennials, advanced biofuels is rolled into the very next one, which is A5, a state biofuels goal. So we've right now got number 3 and number 5. So we've got the increase in perennials on that chart, and we've got the biofuels on the chart, and we should have cover crops, but let's see. Maybe it's hiding somewhere. One of them is a cost saver that is significantly influenced, as I understand it, by federal income that flows in support of these practices, federal payments. We see significant savings in terms of greenhouse gas emissions here. So to the earlier question about this dynamic where we're making progress on residential stuff, but it's headed the wrong direction on agriculture, this was an attempt to shine a light in that area and do something about it. Cost per ton, and it varies significantly here. Okay, forestry, we have the protection of peatlands, which is not being quantified. That was, in the judgment of the agencies, a complex one at this time in terms of some of the science that's progressing. And then best management practices, things like enhanced thinning programs and the generation of biomass for use in buildings. Community forests, sometimes called urban forests, and a forest health issue, which is disturbance response, and then conservation of natural land, which is predominantly an easement program. On the community forest and the conservation of natural lands, you see pretty big numbers there in terms of how much this cost. And that's because this represents the total cost of that program, not the cost that is being proposed here to make this get carbon reductions. Literally, the design specifications, you know, for the program as is were provided to our team, and the question we were asked to answer was, so status quo, if this thing goes forward, how much carbon do you get out of it? So this is a total program cost, and you look at the amount of carbon coming out of it. And the amount of carbon coming out relative to that total cost is not huge, and that gives you some pretty high-looking cost figures on these. It's not that there isn't carbon coming out of it. It's just we're counting the cost of the entire easement program, or the cost of the entire community forestry program, and you need to put that in perspective. A little bit of out-of-state action going on here. Same issue in terms of cost effectiveness. We see just very large numbers on the easement program, again, because this is just scoring out the total cost of that program versus carbon. And same with the cost per option. So we have not finished the work on waste management. We'll be bringing that back to you, but it's wastewater treatment efficiency, waste reduction, recycling, and composition. And that concludes the presentation of results. My apologies again for too much information. It's kind of the nature of the beast right now. We'll have this completed and converted into the macro stuff later, and we'll try to also shrink wrap this down into things that are a little bit simpler in terms of indicators, but hopefully at this stage you'll have a little bit better sense of what's under the hood here in terms of what's being engineered through this overall set of things. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both David and Mr. Peterson. Very thorough. Thank you. Questions or comments from members of the board? I know we have two folks that would like to make some public comment, and I think it's on this issue. And so while you're thinking about that, I think maybe I'd like to, questions? Do you have more in the presentation, or are we at?
Well, I'll just one more slide, and then perhaps with David's assistance, we'll wrap this up here. But as I mentioned, we'll be finishing up the work I just presented, and if necessary, expanding the scenarios on these. And then, as I mentioned, we're putting this all together. Some of these that I showed you that are separate are not designed to be separate. Really, they're designed to be hooked together. It's the only way they make sense. What, for instance, on the electric vehicles program is envisioned is that that's being tied to a very specific expanded use of renewables to feed the electricity demand for those vehicles. So we're going to hook them together. As I mentioned, the jobs numbers, and we use something called the regional economic modeling system, REMI system. It's actually a program the state has and uses for other purposes. In fact, it's one of the more widely used macroeconomic models that's in the U.S. at the state level. It's used typically for budgeting purposes. It's been used increasingly, and we've led a lot of this work for energy and environmental analysis, but this is basically asking the question of how are you spending your money now? And what happens if you spend it differently? And it's called a spend shift model. So it's going to hammer on the fiscal impacts side of this and then tell you when you change the way you spend money, what does it mean in terms of the effect of that on people's jobs and income, et cetera? The implementation portion of this is going to become more refined for the purposes of that second level analysis, because it will need to specify outlays and specify sources and uses in order to do these calculations, but for perhaps a larger reason, which is one of the goals of this process, was really to focus on the implementation needs of these options and what that meant at a more specific level in terms of the programs. And that is likely to be the focus of future conversations, is really getting a lot more clarity and participation around the implementation. And that will involve, we'll be doing some technical webinars for stakeholders, which will let them get into a little bit more detail around each of these things after they have a chance tomorrow to receive this overall briefing. And then the state will be hosting implementation meetings with stakeholders as well that, as I mentioned, in terms of the implementation focus, will really help to provide a lot more detail around what this means at an institutional level. We'll be coming back with all of the results, including the macro results, next year to show how this all finishes out, and then providing some level of technical assistance along the way. David?
I'd be overwhelmed if I were you. I'll let Will talk about how you can, where people can go to get this presentation, because they might want to look at it a little more closely. I will warn people that some of the numbers are going to change as we finalize our work. Even some of the things that were presented today, there's a small chance that some of the numbers will get corrected. And there were a few policies, as you saw, electric vehicles, for example, that we're still working on. There is a lot of opportunity here if you're interested in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, particularly in the electrical supply side sector and the electricity demand side management sector. There are a lot of opportunities in other areas that are potentially great ideas for other reasons, and we want to look at that. And here's an example. It's not labeled this, but one of the supply or energy options is really looking at things that can be done to replace propane use in rural Minnesota. And from last winter, we all know that there's a lot of reason why we want to look at that. So there's other reasons to look at some of these policies as well. And then finally, because the full-scale economic analysis hasn't been done, keep that in mind. Some of the costs that are associated with some of these options are going to look a lot different when we look at the number of jobs that are created and other kinds of things that spring from investing that money in that manner. So what might not look cost-effective at this stage of the process might feel really cost-effective when the work is done in later this year and early next year.
Do you think that are all benefits quantifiable? In other words, are there some that just happen and that we just can't know?
The known knowns and the unknown unknowns?
Yeah, that.
We can't quantify all of the benefits. I'll just leave it at that. Okay. We can quantify some of them using these very robust models, but as the chair pointed out earlier, models are wrong. We think they're going to give us useful information, but in some cases there are things that we just can't quantify, and we're not doing that. And we will be speaking to some of the ups and downs in those areas, but we won't be assigning numbers to them.
Just some clarification, too. With respect to the stakeholder process, Environmental Initiative is facilitating a multi-month stakeholder process on this project. So in terms of documents and availability of documents, as they're finalized, they'll be available on the Environmental Initiative webpage, as well as Tom's presentation today. And there's a link from our site there, too. So you can either follow us via GovDelivery, loop into the EI process through their website, or just go through our website. So multiple pathways to get at the information, or you can just call us and let us know, and we'll help you out. But just a couple comments about the stakeholder process. There, we're going to have webinars that are going to provide the technical background on each policy within each sector. They're going to be organized by sector over the next couple months, and then we'll also have in-person stakeholder meetings for each sector. So the meeting tomorrow is more of an open, more in-depth presentation than this today. We're going to dive into the policies in more specifics, and then we're going to go even deeper on a sector-by-sector basis over the next couple months, and then we'll wrap up the stakeholder process, I believe, in March. So a lot to come. We'll continue to send out notifications and scheduling updates online through GovDelivery.
Brian?
I'm curious. I know you... You took a look at policies that are possible or achievable or desirable. I'm wondering, your introduction indicated that you're worldwide, you work worldwide with companies. I'm curious if you have, in your experience working with other countries that are accepting of nuclear power, given the huge amount of greenhouse gases that come from power generation, what would our graph look like if it included a nuclear power option or an additional plant instead of Sherco, switching to natural? What if it was nuclear? I'm just curious what the numbers would look like.
I don't know offhand. We would literally have to run that to see. I simply don't know. There's a lot of variation in terms of the approaches to nuclear power from one place to the next. And so Minnesota would need to take its own specific look at that issue.
Other questions or comments? If not, thank you both. It's a massive amount of work and a huge undertaking, and thank you for traveling the distance today to come here and present.
Thank you.
We have two folks that have requested a chance to visit on this issue. I'm going to go with Muna Khalif, Muna, and Tess Ergen. And I probably butchered those names. And then following that, Tim Rudnicki.
It's actually pretty spot on, so not bad.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And could you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes. So I'm Muna Khalif, and I'm representing the Sierra Club as well as the American Relief Agency for the Horn of Africa.
And I'm Tess Ergen.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Muna Khalif.
And I'm Tess Ergen. Chairman and board members, first and foremost, it's a privilege to be of attendance today with you.
We thank you and acknowledge the commitment you've all taken to improve climate solution and economic development for Minnesota. This hard work you is implementing within the production of collaboration of the Majestic Handbook, Minnesota and Climate Change. Our tomorrow starts today, led by our very own EQP.
As a citizen of this world and a resident of Minnesota, I stand before you as a representative of the youthful generation that wants Minnesotans to be leaders of sustainability policies for a better tomorrow. I take pride in Minnesota's progressive reputation and our state's commitment to do better by the people and for the people. As you may know, Minnesota is currently a leading state for achieving a carbon rule. It is the eighth best state in clean technology leadership and fourth best state for favorable policies. This, ladies and gentlemen, deserves a round of applause. And recognition that without committees such as yourself, and the unity of citizens alike, this could not have been possible. So I ask, why stop? I say we continue to move strides for a great state, Next, with renewable energy and energy efficiency by enacting the proposed Clean Power Plan. Climate change, a once far-off concern, is now knocking at our door and demanding attention and immediate action. Coal combustion to produce electricity is the single biggest source of Minnesota pollution. In effect, various health concerns, such as asthma, the principal cause of school absences, hinders our youth's potential to reach a better tomorrow. I favor the idea of clean energy as it will improve our well-being as well as our environment. I favor to raise my family here in Minnesota just as I have in order to enjoy the prairie lands that are so distinct and unique to our home. And I believe the Clean Power Plan can be the small step in the right direction to protect and keep pollution out of our water, our breathless air, and provide a better forthcoming for our children and grandchildren. Therefore, EQB Chairman and members, I ask of you to lay the blueprint of our tomorrow by moving forward the Clean Power Plan today.
My identity as a Somali American has never allowed me to be an isolationist. Being a Somali American means to live within the intersection of two nations. Therefore, I subscribe to the idea that I'm a citizen of the world. Speaking English, Somali, and Arabic has played a pivotal role in allowing me to see beyond borders and to understand how interconnected the world really is. I've come to reality that with safeguarding our own security, we must first ensure the security of others. It is as simple as that. As a result, I have become indoctrinated with the idea of bettering both intersections. See, the thing is, the evidence is all around us. Climate change has been identified as a leading human and environmental crisis of the 21st century. And unless we act now, we will see catastrophic consequences, including rising sea levels, drought, famine, and a loss of up to a third of the world's plant and animal species. African nations are among the lightest polluters, but analysts say they will suffer the most from climate change in the pursuit of water, food security, sustainable development, political and economic sustainability. It is careless to say that pollution from Minnesota will only stay within the boundaries of the state. The Clean Power Energy Plan is not only a local impact, but international phenomenon. A malicious virus that can be stopped before it consumes the souls of the innocent. Ladies and gentlemen, even if we rally together and the odds are not in your favor, choose to rise again, let your voices be heard, and they are your weapon to unleashing a revolution in this world. We stand before you as two individuals united by the undeniable fact that we need to address a policy for the carbon pollution. It has the ability to change not only Minnesota, but the world around us. We speak up in hope for the two intersection words are colliding to mark the beginning of something new.
Here in this box, we bring forth 3,640 Minnesota voices in support of a strong, just, clean power plan. Also outside, we have the photo gallery of the Horn of Africa, which shows about what Muna said with the droughts and such that the climate change has impacted.
So. The United States as well as other parts of the world.
Yeah. So please hear us and thank you.
Take this out and show you guys how many we've had. And as Tess mentioned, these are the voices of 3,640 Minnesotans. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on your effort to have those cards signed by folks all across Minnesota. You're an inspiration.
Thank you. Well, it's an honor to be here, so thank you.
Young folks taking this challenge on. I bet you voted too, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, we're not that young. I'm almost 21, and so.
I don't think that's what he meant.
Any questions for? Our guests? If not, again, thank you on
Absolutely.
Behalf of the board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rudnicki. Tim is here representing Minnesota Biofuels Association. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Yes, my name is Tim Rudnicki, Minnesota Biofuels Association. And I guess we've heard a lot about numbers, and I promise to keep this short, but I would like to connect a few dots for everybody. perhaps you, as I, were very impressed maybe with the Minnesota and Climate Change, Our Tomorrow Starts Today summary, which includes things that are certainly close to me, like biofuels. And I was intrigued by the reference to the nearly 874,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide that have been reduced so far by biofuels in the state of Minnesota. And all I'd like to do at this point is correct the record. And I think there are a lot of myths, there are a lot of assumptions, and there are a lot of preconceived notions about biofuels and ethanol. And the only point I'd like to leave with you today is part of the solution to the challenge that you've heard is already with us right here, right now, today. And some people don't like to say the word ethanol, but I will say it. Ethanol, which comes from cornstarch, despite popular beliefs, if you examine the energy used to make the fertilizer, to plant the seed, to cultivate, to harvest, to process into ethanol, and then actually use in a vehicle, worst case scenario, including indirect land use challenge, which has just been questioned yesterday through the Iowa University study, even if you include that, it's 34% fewer greenhouse gas emissions compared to gasoline, petroleum gasoline. And then if you look at the broader range of ethanol production, it ranges as high as 57% fewer greenhouse gas emissions. So why do I share that with you? I think one of the slides, and I didn't have binoculars with me, but I was intrigued by the reference.
That's a Minnesota passive aggressive.
I was intrigued by the reference to advanced biofuels. And what I'd like to leave with everybody today is that today's Minnesota-based biofuel producers have done some incredible things. And it, since the headwaters of the Mississippi is here, I'll reference the Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico. At the very time ethanol production was increasing, the hypoxia zone was shrinking and has shrunk. At the same time that we see an increase in the production of ethanol, we actually see the number of cultivated acres declining. And we can go to the USDA data, and we can go to Minnesota data, and we can validate this. But there are a lot of assumptions that all of a sudden we're taking forest land and that's being farmed. That's not the case. That's not what the facts show. But more importantly, back to the greenhouse gas emissions, Minnesota biofuel producers have figured out how to, with current technology, decrease water use, how to use storm water, how to use municipal effluent wastewater as a way to process ethanol. So there's some incredible technological things going on, and to the chair's point, not all models capture everything and may not be entirely accurate. I think we're going to have a lot to talk about as we refine these models. But the point, again, is part of the solution is here and now. With 1.1 billion gallons of ethanol being produced in Minnesota, if we were able to use all of that in the state of Minnesota, that would be comparable to reducing travel of 600,000 vehicles or close to 650,000 vehicles in the state of Minnesota just by using ethanol, traditional ethanol. And some of our producers are looking at different ways of using the fiber of the corn, which is a form of advanced biofuel. But it's a way of using that resource, which is brought to one location. It's a form of biomass. It's using it more efficiently. So I guess I'll just conclude by saying it's clear there is a challenge that remains to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Our association and our producers, the men and women that are in the countryside but supply all of us in the state with renewable fuels, we're here to work with the EQB and other agencies to more fully inform the record and to truly take advantage of a solution that is here right now. We don't need to wait for a new technological engine. We don't need to wait for everybody driving a hybrid. We don't need to wait for fuel cell vehicles. If we used E15 today, only 5% more ethanol compared to what we're currently using in gasoline, we could go from 874,000 metric tons onward, upward to 2.2 million and maybe 2.6 million metric tons, ultimately, if we met the petroleum displacement goals in Minnesota. Those are real numbers. That's the equivalent of removing a lot of vehicles from the highway, and it's a real solution. Again, right here, right now. And it's a technology that we can build upon. And again, I look forward to having these continued discussions with the appropriate agencies. And I think it was said in one of the policy slide works, we have a policy framework, and we have to talk about barrier removal. So if more folks had the chance to use higher blends of ethanol, we'd be well on our way to solving a big problem. So thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate your continued efforts on this front.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Rudnicki? So you have some problems with the matrix numbers that you had a hard time seeing up there.
Yes. I think several things. The matrix was shallow with respect to the full range of biofuels, and I believe the metrics didn't reflect the latest research from Argonne National Laboratory, the National Renewable Energy Lab, nor did it include information from the Department of Energy and the U.S. EPA. And we pride ourselves in using good science to make well-informed decisions, and we're prepared, again, to work with EQB and other agencies to make sure everybody has that information.
Okay, I know Mr. Peterson's still in the room and is hearing you, and I think David is also, so thank you. If there are no other questions, thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you.
We're going to move to the last item on the agenda. And I'd like to ask Heather Ahrens to please come up. And we'll go to the silica sand technical advisory team and ordnance library update. Exciting stuff to get back into the discussion of silica sand. So we go from climate change to this easy one, right?
Yeah.
Welcome, Heather.
Thank you. I'm just going to take a few minutes to give you an update on some progress with silica sand related projects. One of them is an enactment of the silica sand technical advisory team, as well as changes that we're planning to make to the ordnance library. Just background. The EQB was given this authority to convene a silica sand technical advisory team upon the request of an LGU to give input upon ordinance develop, zoning, environmental review, permitting, monitoring, other issues arising from silica sand. The goals of the technical advisory team from the start has been just to provide an easy avenue to the state expertise and not to necessarily be cumbersome or overly rigorous. It's supposed to be geared towards, the LGU at hand. We want it to be open and transparent to the public, bring together agency expertise and be flexible and focused on, the request at hand. We've done this in two ways. There's been a very informal process where people have, come to the EQB and asked for state expertise, and we've been able them to guide them through the state agencies. We've gotten informal requests for information from the City of Wabasha, City of Winona, Houston County, Lyon Township, Fillmore County. There's been presentations by state agency staff to the Southeast Midwestern Water Resource and also to the Minnesota Tribal Council. But on September 25th, we've had a more formal request for the silica technical advisory team. On September 25th, the City of Wabasha asked if we could look over their mining ordinance and specifically address 11 questions that they posed. On the 8th, we noticed this meeting. On the 13th, we had the meeting. And on the 5th, this draft document was received. Throughout this whole period, we've been in close contact with the city of Wabasha and working with the representative of the city. Also to have, you know, I was hoping to have more of a final release to you at this point in time, but in talking to the representative, they were interested in having more of an iterative process where the commission, their planning commission, can take a look at this document and to have any maybe clarifying questions or get additional input on and some of the responses that we provided. I've also worked specifically with the representative, and she has provided some, you know, what are some clarifying points. So we will, you know, make modifications to the document, with that in mind. And then the next steps will include just presenting this information to the City of Wabasha Planning Commission, which will be noticed to the public as well. Agency representatives that were gathered for this particular stat. I think there's some confusion that there is just a sitting board, but of stat membership. And really what we want to do is cater who sits on that particular team depending on the questions at hand. So, you know, as the questions come in, we can form the stat that best addresses the project. For this particular stat, we had memberships from the Pollution Control Agency, the DNR, Department of Transportation, Bowser, Department of Health, and EQB. There are 11 questions in total, and just for time constraints, I don't have a lot of the time to go in detail, but it was related to air quality, reclamation, water use, borehole requirements, fueling distances, environmental review, stormwater discharge, water well survey, processing volumes, and then mining cell size. So like I said, we'll field these questions from the city, we'll get a finalized document, and then present it in December, I think December 9th. So from that point, I will just move into what we've been doing with the library. And the deadline for the library was October 1st to have something put together. And it was an amazing timeline considering everything that had to be done back in last October 1st. But now we had some time to maybe look and organize the data that and maybe gather even more information that might be usable for the library. And so to do that, I have this mock-up, which is what we hope to produce on our website when we get a developer. But it's to kind of categorize the information within the library so that people can sort it and identify things that they might be interested or ordinances that they might want to grab from. So it's going to be a sortable table that will be available on the web. This is a mock-up. It's draft. It hasn't, I'm still working through some of the finalization processes. But for example, if people just want to look at ordinances, they can sort based on from A to Z. They can sort and see where moratoriums are specifically or where there might be ordinances. I should mention that, in the process of doing this, I expanded the library to include more documents, and it's doubled. So not only is there ordinances, but there are permits. There are, local studies that have been commissioned. Environmental review of mining projects. For example, if someone was interested in looking at what ordinances might specify air monitoring requirements, they'd be able to figure, go straight to that. I've added websites and links to the LGU or specific permit, for example, if you go to here, this is all the permitting documents for Great Plains Sands, which is, and so people will have just more straightforward access. The date adopted or downloaded is also included. In the process of gathering this information, I made sure that as we scan it, there is optical that can be basically the PDFs can be searched. And the same with the document for the silica the technical advisory team. That document is produced so that it is also accessible and web accessible for people with. And so moving forward, I think, you know, I think the library will be an ongoing process just to keep it relevant and to potentially expand it. I think there could be even more, you know, more growth to it. But I think it's something that we can, you know, continue on as there's more information available, more ordinances that are adopted, as well as maybe even look outside of Minnesota for ordinances as well. I'll open up to any questions.
Questions for Heather? Please.
Well, I don't think I have a question, but I just, having followed this pretty closely, I just want to say what a remarkable implementation of this idea that the EQBA staff has done. And I'm just so impressed to see what kind of access a local government can have and very specific addressing of questions. I mean, I'm very aware of what it would have taken for any LGU or any citizen to try to get this kind of authoritative expertise onto the table in the past, and I am just really stunned and grateful. It's really impressive, yeah.
Thanks, Kristen. Yeah. Other comments or questions?
I would certainly echo the previous comments. This is, as a member of an LGU that sits on an ordinance committee, to have access to this type of expertise that is going to get back to you in a short period of time with a concise, well-thought-out, well-drafted document, that's really good. In particular, I also like the fact that you had additional comments. You didn't just answer the 11 questions. You also made some observations and brought those along. So I thought you did a really good thing. The question, I think we covered this earlier with the executive director, but maybe just for the board's purposes, you can reiterate. The EQB is able to provide the service because of funding through the legislature, and that funding is good for what period of time?
That's correct. The funding is in our permanent budget.
So I think, Mr. Chair, that's just what I wanted the board to be aware of, the fact that this service is going to be provided by us, you know, until we probably get all of these ordinances in place anyways. And then lastly, this library, having a searchable library for an LGU to go through and look at something like this, that's great. And then once again, a question, I think, for the executive director. I know we're looking to get our environmental review program put on the web, and I think this is probably the is this the model we'll follow, a searchable database similar to this?
That is certainly the vision. With this particular exercise, it was mandated by the legislature, so we have allocated some resources to work with a contractor through Minit to convert this mock-up into a website that's accessible and searchable and easy to follow. The environmental review component is a little bit more complicated because this is only 30 or 40 documents. Environmental review is 40 boxes of a lot of information. And so it's a priority for us that we get those documents scanned and have them available online in a way that's meaningful to the public and LGUs and project proposers. However, there are costs to that. And so we're hopeful we can seek resources to procure that.
I just think it's a great service that the EQB provides, and it really brings relevancy to the EQB that have the
yes.
It's an awful lot of work that takes place, and if we don't showcase it, advertise it, make it available, it's for one-time use rather than perpetual use.
Keep in mind it's in our base budget, but that you know, we're going through budgeting processes right now, and we'll see how that all plays out.
Mr. Chair, I also wanted to mention that I thought it was extremely useful in the commentary to Wabasha that the staff was able to really explain a lot more about how environmental review is supposed to take place and who does what. I mean, that's an opportunity, I think, that is really great every time it happens when that is applied in a particular situation. It was well done in this, too.
Thanks, Kristen. Other comments or questions? If not, I want to thank all of you around this table for hanging in. We lost a few, but not too bad. And, the same for those that took time out of your schedule to come and sit through these three presentations. So thanks to all of you. With that, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
There is. Is there a second?
Second.
There is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign. Motion carried. We stand in adjournment.